Hey guys, this is Eric. In light of the passing of Leonard Nimoy, Brother Jay and I have decided to take on all of the Star Trek movies, at least that Leonard Nimoy was involved in. Well, or at least up until Star Trek VI. This will be the first of those episodes. Welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The Brothers Anderson are... This is Eric.
It is better to be truthful and good than to not.
This is Brother Jay.
You ask me if I have a God complex? Let me tell you something. I am God.
This is Drew.
There is a storm coming like nothing you have ever seen, and not a one of you is prepared for it.
And they are sometimes joined by guests like...
This is Travis.
I had to stop her from screaming.
And Diane.
If you men only knew.
So sit back, close your eyes, and let us take you away. Unless you're driving, in which case keep your eyes open and watch the road and, you know, anyway. Welcome, this is Eric.
This is Brother Jay.
And tonight we're going to talk about the 1979 Star Trek, the motion picture, directed by Academy Award winning director Robert Wise.
Weiss? In the Germanic world, it would be actually Weiss, but it's Weiss.
I stand corrected. So any housekeeping before we start Star Trek?
I listened to the Thin Lizzy music episode. I'm not a huge Thin Lizzy fan. I probably have a little bit of Drewism to me that because you and Drew listened to it, I kind of eschewed it most of the time I came in contact with it. And there's a couple songs, but listening to it through kind of the prism of your guys' recollection and memories kind of made me, you know, I kind of reevaluate things. I thought it was interesting that you made the point that he kind of had a Jimi Hendrix tone, because very early on, I thought he sounded a lot like Jimi Hendrix myself. So I was kind of happy to get that kind of validation. I also thought that it was kind of funny that, I was kind of surprised that you said that he was a black man, because I didn't realize he was a black man, much in the same way that I didn't realize Van Morrison was a white guy. So, you know, not that I care, but it's just when you're little, because I was little when I heard a lot of both Thin Lizzy and Van Morrison, the mental picture that went in my head went with the stereotype of what I learned in my surroundings, not for good or bad or indifferent. I love Van Morrison, but I was shocked when I saw a picture of the man. I enjoyed kind of listening to the songs. Although, like I said, I have to find the track from Semisonic that I think is most blatantly ripped off from Thin Lizzy now. So.
Oh yeah, you'll have to let me know, because I'm intrigued.
Yeah, I have the CD. I just have to find the track.
It took forever. This is the longest editing I've ever had to do. It's not the longest I've recorded. I mean, it was just like 2.5 hours, which is seems like a lot, but it wasn't really a lot in terms of the other recordings we made, Manchurian Candidate, for instance. But it took a long time, because doing research, I went down YouTube holes, and editing, I went down holes as far as, well, okay, maybe I can actually find a lot of this stuff. And then you got to find it and chop it into an acceptable piece and then fit it in there. And then it took me a long time comparatively long after just recording that initial liner note story to put the appropriate effects to make it come out cheesy but fun. I tried actually to turn it into my 13-year-old self reading the story, like by upping the pitch a little bit. That did weird things with the stereo, and I was like, we're gonna leave it the way it is. But and it was funny, because, you know, like a lot like 2001, for instance, when I was editing, after we had already recorded the podcast, I found some interesting facts that I didn't know. So I was like, oh, well, this would have made things make a little more sense. But oh well. I mean, I think our story at least has a strong narrative.
No, I liked it. I mean, I was able to listen to it, you know, in its entirety, and a couple points made me chuckle. So
Yeah, well, then of course there's always the story of the quest for the hot dogs and such. So.
Yeah, no, I thought that was, it brought back memories.
Well, and it's funny to hear Drew tell a story that I was in, because he takes, you know, I mean, he looked at it from a completely different perspective. So he takes a completely different, like, message out of the whole story. Not necessarily in this game. I mean, I think we both took the message that, you know, don't drugs are bad. But, you know, he just has a different perspective. So certain things that I thought were like high points in the story, he didn't even remember. And yet he remembers all the, some of the little things that make some of it even appear sweeter in my mind. Anyway, it was very interesting. So it was a little trip down memory lane, which is always kind of fun. So,
but back to Star Trek.
Yeah. Well, first of all, the reason why we're doing the Star Trek, we're going to do all cover what, 7 movies?
Maybe we're going to do at least this. I think I'd like to go at least through the 6 of the original series, and then if we want to go into the reboot, because Leonard Nimoy is in the reboot too, but I think that might be too much. Also, we might reevaluate, you know, because Star Trek V,
arguably the worst of the series, Star Trek V.
Yeah, which is ironic because it's all about Spock and his brother. So we may shift, you know, after I rewatch them, and I'll probably watch most of the rest of them this weekend and next weekend. I may reevaluate things depending on how things shake out, but at the very least, I wanted to go back and kind of revisit this.
Yeah, well, it's because we lost Leonard Nimoy this week. He was 83 years old, died of complications from COPD, and whenever a beloved actor dies, you get to reflect on how much, you know, he wasn't just Mr. Spock from Star Trek, although he certainly was that. In fact, I think he has an autobiography called I Am Not Spock, and then he did another autobiography afterward that's titled I Am Spock.
That's brilliant.
Because he had to kind of reevaluate his thought of being pigeonholed. And it
well, and after a certain point, when you realize it's making you nothing but money, I mean, you got to kind of embrace it.
Exactly. Yeah, because you're not going to be able to fight it, so you might as well embrace it. Plus,
yeah, and
there's
milk that train.
Well, and there's some other issues, personality issues, but we're going to get into that a little bit with the history. You definitely have a fondness for this film.
I do, and I was kind of reflecting some this weekend, because when I heard that he had passed away, I was kind of, it was a bummer. And it's funny how much I can be touched by the death of someone who I've never even met. I have no familiarity with him as a man, you know, as a person, individual, Leonard Nimoy. I only know him as the actor, and I've seen him in works and other films and TV shows and things. So, and I will preface this that I am not a big Star Wars guy. And I was thinking this weekend, I was pondering over why is it that Star Trek resonated with me more than Star Wars? Because I've seen them both, and they both kind of were in the same time frame that I was introduced to, because Star Trek was obviously before I was born, the original. But, you know, I grew up watching it on TV in Anchorage. But I think for me, the reason that Star Trek resonated more with me is because more of the characters tended to be humanoid and not this fantastical alien furry creatures that I couldn't kind of stretch my brain around as existing. And so I could more personify the Star Trek universe and put myself into that universe and see it being more realistic and futuristic than Star Wars. Star Wars seemed futuristic and much more fantastical as opposed to Star Trek, which seemed futuristic and plausible.
I'm going to dive into the history. How about that? I'm going to ask permission.
Okay.
Ha-ha.
Sure.
Let's start out with the history. And again, this is much like the Thin Lizzy episode where we talked history in the beginning. This is, of course, the history as I put it together. If there turns out to be some factual errors or some misquotes, then I apologize in advance. But here's the history as far as I was able to cobble together and how I remember it, at least during the parts of it which I was alive. So, Gene Roddenberry created Star Trek, the television series, and it ran from 1966 to 1969. It was 3 full seasons, and the whole idea of it was a Western set in space. There were a lot of other Westerns that were popular on TV as well as the movies. And he wanted to pattern it on sort of a Gulliver's Travel sort of thing, where every episode would work as an adventure story, but also as a morality tale. And some of them are heavier than others, but pretty much all of them had that morality tale element to it. And from the very get-go, it was a weird series. They commissioned NBC, commissioned a pilot called The Cage, and they shot it. But NBC rejected that pilot. They liked the idea, but they didn't like the actual product. But instead of just scrapping it and going on to something else, they said, okay, make us a second pilot. So they made this Where No Man Has Gone Before pilot. And then they launched the series. And the series started strong, but never really had great ratings. So during the second season, NBC was going to cancel it. But unprecedented at the time, there was this letter writing campaign by fans that saved it. So it ran three full seasons and finally NBC canceled it because the ratings never improved, but the fans were so supportive of it.
Yeah.
So the rights to it were owned by Desilu, the production company.
And, which we all know.
Yes.
Well, Desi Arnaz and Lucille Ball.
Yes. And Paramount bought the syndication rights from Desilu. And of course they started syndicating it. And so, you know, that's how we saw it in Anchorage. And Gene Roddenberry was lobbying Paramount to continue the series by way of a movie. So they actually agreed to it and started working on a movie project in 75. But they never could really come up with a script that the studio liked, that Roddenberry liked. So it was scrapped, and Roddenberry was going to do this new series called Star Trek Phase 2. And Star Trek Phase 2, one of the stars of that, a 5-year deal, in fact, was this woman we would get to know in this movie, Persis Kambada. She played Ilya, the bald chick. Uh-huh. Yeah, this is going to be her breakout role. They gave her a 5-year deal, and they had the Vulcan science officer in this movie that we're going to talk about was actually going to be a big part of the TV series. So he kind of got short shrift, but anyway, then what happened was Star Wars came out in 77 and just made a ton of money. And it was kind of considered a fluke, but when Close Encounters of the Third Kind came out and did well, Paramount then canceled the TV series and planned to make a movie. They figured, hey, science fiction movies are back. So we have the science fiction property. Let's go back and make it a new movie. So took the cast of the Star Trek Phase 2 television show, and they took the pilot script, and pretty much, at least as it appears to me, they stretched an hour-long script into a 2-hour-long movie.
Okay.
And they hired Robert Wise, the director of The Day the Earth Stood Still, The Haunting, The Sound of Music, West Side Story, Run Silent, Run Deep, The Andromeda Strain, among others. And they announced as this huge fanfare that he was going to direct this $15 million budget feature film, which is all fine and good. The problem is they didn't have a good script. In fact, the movie kept being written and rewritten like crazy. And the final cut of the movie was done 2 days before the premiere. Like, literally, Robert Wise had to hand-deliver the reels to the theater for the premiere.
I will say that I love this movie, but it's not a good movie.
Yeah.
I will volunteer that it's not a good movie. I mean, it's a great movie for me because it's a Star Trek movie, and I love the movie. I love the visuals. But the story is definitely lacking. And also, you have to have a familiarity with the history of the show to have got some of the story of the movie.
Yeah, it did some things really well. I mean, it wasn't like I was not happy to watch it again. I watched it twice this week to get ready for this, and I was happy to watch it both times. And I've got so much fondness for the characters that helps a long way. I mean, I remember seeing this in the theater. I'm sure we all went as a family, right?
to this one?
Yeah, well, I know I saw it at the Polar Theater.
I don't think so. I don't think I went and saw this at the theater.
Oh, maybe I saw it with, like, Uncle John maybe, or with...
Maybe it was Uncle John or the Albrechts or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember Star Trek II, the Wrath of Khan. I remember seeing that in the movie theater.
Well, I definitely remember this in the movie theater because it was weird to experience even in the theater. And we'll get there. But anyway, so back to the history real quick. We'll kind of get through this because it makes a huge understanding what we ended up with. You have to kind of understand how they got there. And so they had problems with the script. And so they had to keep reworking. And depending on who you talk to, especially Shatner, everybody was making editing and script decisions all the time. I mean, they were just coming up with things like writing it on the spot. And this $15 million movie ended up costing $46 million to make, which at the time was almost a record. The only reason it wasn't the most expensive movie ever made at the time is because when you combine Superman and Superman 2 together, it came up to more than $100 million. So they called Superman 1 a $50 million movie.
But it made a ton of money.
Oh, yeah. It made $139, but it was considered not... They didn't consider that to be what they wanted. They expected a lot more. Luckily, it did make money because it allowed them to make more movies. They scaled back the budget dramatically, though, for Star Trek II, which I think, at least in my estimation, is a far superior film.
Absolutely.
But that has a lot to do with the script and what they wanted to do. Because this is definitely an introduction movie. This is kind of an origin story movie. Not to the characters, but to the continuing adventures of the Enterprise.
Yeah, and it was also a way to kind of get the fans excited. Since we're kind of talking about the history of it, Robert Weiss took direct approval of every extra in the movie, which is crazy. Most directors do not do that. That's usually staffed out. But Weiss... he wanted connected to every extra. Also, most of the extras that you see, because they said on the budget of a TV show, we could never show the entire crew of the ship because there's, 400 and some extras that you would need. Nobody's going to pay that. But he went and got waivers from the Screen Actors Guild, and he got most of the people that you see on the ship as extras are fans.
Oh, which is awesome. I mean, yeah, that was like the group of people who wrote letters, 10 years later.
Exactly. So it was kind of a good payback, but also a way to get them invested and a way to get them buzzing about it. And, word of mouth is very big, especially back in those days when, that kind of word of mouth was the best advertising because, advertising was expensive and much more difficult, especially in certain markets. So.
Well, and this was, this is the days of people lining up around the block to see Star Wars. This is a big time in movies.
Yeah.
Again, the Superman movies were coming out and Star Wars was in, it was already a thing and we knew it was going to be a bigger thing. And but there was another problem, though, with getting this movie made. And that was no Leonard Nimoy. He's the reason for the season of us doing this whole list of movies in a row. But he was kind of on the outs with Paramount, not on the outs with them. They were on the outs with him because he hadn't been paid some royalties from Star Trek. And he's like, I'm not going to work for you people. I don't want to be Spock again. And you haven't paid me for when I was Spock last time. So luckily, Robert Weiss had children. His daughter and son-in-law told him basically that you can't replace Spock. Like, they fully intended to. The guy we meet in the very beginning that Kirk talks to, who's the science officer that ends up in a, spoiler, in a transporter accident.
Oh,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, he was scheduled to be in the cast of the television show Phase 2. He was going to be in the movie. But then Leonard Nimoy at the end, when Jeffrey Katzenberg went to New York City to meet with him personally.
Wow.
He hand-delivered him a check for the royalty money they owed him.
Wow.
And they also said, we need you to do this. So he said, okay, but he didn't like the script. And he did end up, though, making a deal with Katzenberg that, A, you know, he got his money. B, he was going to show up at the press conference with everybody else. But C, he had final script approval. So that's pretty ballsy.
Yeah, that's a pretty big deal.
Yeah.
But replacing him would have probably landed this in Obscurville.
Yeah, I think so. We're going to talk about characters because some of the cast and crew, some of the crew of the Enterprise, the cast of characters that we all think very fondly of, kind of got short shrift in this particular script.
Well, this is very much kind of a Kirk and Spock story.
Well, Kirk and Spock, but then also Bones and Scotty are big parts of the story.
Kind of ish.
Well, they get a lot more screen time. I mean, Bones is an important character in the story. Without him, certain plot points don't move along. And Scotty is a constant presence because of all the problems with the ship that are kind of a hallmark of the series.
Yeah.
Plus, he has another fun thing. Did you know that James Doohan created the Klingon language?
I didn't know that, but just if you didn't know, you can get the movie in Klingon.
Well, okay, let me rephrase the trivia, though. He didn't create the Klingon language. He created the Klingon dialogue. He invented that gibberish that they speak in the beginning. By the way, the Klingon captain played Spock's dad in the original series.
Huh.
Can't really tell from under the makeup. But so the linguist, the actual linguist who came back and made Klingon into an actual language with all the elements of a language that you need, that guy based it all on James Doohan's kind of gibberish.
Wow.
It's quite an accomplishment.
God knows he probably didn't get paid for any of that.
Well, who knows? I mean, it's... there were a lot of, you know, for all the things with like Nimoy coming in kind of at the last minute and the fact that some of the cast didn't really get along very well. They were, I think Doohan's twin kids were in the movie.
Yes. Yeah, they were.
Shatner's wife was in the movie. So there were a lot of people that got in there, and there were a lot of cast members that could have easily been replaced were part of this movie.
Well, and Stephen Collins said, that he very much, from beginning to end, he felt like an outsider. But that he took that, and since the character himself was pretty much an outsider, he said, you know, I just kind of exemplified that. I just kind of turned that to my advantage, and I just made that very method.
Well, I was really impressed with him, actually, in this movie.
Me too.
I mean, I think he probably had the strongest performance in the entire movie.
Yeah, he was the best actor out of the whole bunch.
Yep. Another piece of trivia that added to the budget, they hired this company, the visual effects company, to come in and do all the visual effects. And they knew, you know, they were going to do new costumes. They were going to do, you know, they have to do all the sets, the interior sets of the ship. They have to do models for the outside. So there's all these visual effects going on, plus the computer effects of things like the warp drive and stuff. Well, the company they hired, $5 million into it, it became clear that they didn't have the ability to finish it on time. And Paramount wasn't as concerned about money as they were about time. They knew that they had to get this movie into theaters on time because they had to strike while the fire was hot.
Yeah.
And or the iron was hot. They had to do something. They had to grab the tiger with the tail and run with it. I don't know what they had to do. So they had to go back and actually they had to replace the visual effects team. So they got Douglas Trumbull, who had done work on 2001, and they got a guy who had just come off of Star Wars and started his own production company, and he came in. So they had, like, really hot guys. So if nothing else, this movie looked fantastic.
Well, and it makes sense that you say that because there are long, sweeping vistas just, like what I would call ship porn, which was totally 2001. I mean, there were so many elements from 2001 in this movie that I wrote down several times. I think you and I texted earlier. I'm like, I wrote down, okay, so like, let's see, 10 minutes in. Wonder how long it's going to take Eric to compare this to 2001.
Yeah.
And so it made me laugh because, you know, there's all these shots of space-suited guys just kind of lolling around outside, you know, free-falling and moving around. But there's also, like, you know, Scotty takes Kirk out in a shuttle and they go around the ship. Like, it's like a 10-minute...
Oh, yeah. It's and they were playing ballet music. I was writing in there. It totally is reminiscent of 2001.
It absolutely. It just totally ripped off. I mean, I don't know what the word is. It's not subtle at all.
Well, and
it was very much just full on theft as far as it's concerned.
Yeah.
But again, pretty good special effects for 1979.
Oh no, it was state of the art effects. In fact, that's the thing, is they had state of the art effects, but you know, Robert Wise said the movie that he delivered to theaters, he considered like a rough cut of the movie that he really wanted to do. This actual film exists in three different forms. The film that was on in the theaters in 79 is the one that I believe I was watching on Netflix streaming. They showed it on broadcast television in 1983 and had 12 minutes of additional footage. And when it was released on VHS, it came out as the special longer version. And then in 2001, the director's edition came out on DVD and VHS, and there was dialogue that wasn't in the theatrical release, and there was dialogue cut that was in the theatrical release. It's 4 minutes longer than the director's edition and had other special effects. They had kind of updated them for 2001.
And fixed some of the errors.
Yeah, the cloud was 83 AUs or something.
Well, and you can see the matte paintings in the background of some of the shots.
Yeah. Yeah, everything looks more beautiful, except that that's not the one I can see streaming.
So I have the director's cut. So.
Yeah, see, and I didn't watch that movie. And granted, there's only subtle differences, I think. I mean, I think I know the differences, but, I mean, obviously it would have been nice to see the director's version. But as I said, Netflix streaming was all I can get out of this one.
No, it was fine. You know, there's not enough material difference between them to really have that, in my opinion, to have that much of an impact between the movies.
One of the criticisms that I could totally see was that picking that director was not a good move, because he was not, I mean, George Lucas was an up and coming, you know, he was one of the Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, you know, new wave of directors, like the auteur directors of the 70s. And Robert Wise was a director from the 50s. So this is a very 50s paced movie.
Yeah.
And that's where it was another, to me, it felt like 2001 because it was so slowly paced.
Yeah, it definitely was a leisurely stroll. And, you know, there's one part of the movie where they make it a point about how, you know, the ship has to be ready in 12 hours. And I wrote down, of course, you've already taken 3 hours to drive around the outside.
Well, that's the thing, is this was just like 2001. And like, they fetishized this ship when they, all the lingering shots of the models, I guess the effects supervisor said that even though the models were pretty big of the ship, he wished they were even bigger because they had to come up with a special lens system to do those shots of the ship, like up close, and how, when they would pan across the ship, and they needed the depth of field to be like maximized. So they used a bunch of trickery, like old school trickery, to make up for the fact that they were doing this thing that had never been done before in such detail. Cause you know, the first Star Wars movie, it opens with that big long look of the, Imperial Destroyer. You just get to see the vastness of how big that ship is, like chasing down that smaller ship. Even before you meet any of the characters, you see that big ship. And so, you know, it's a big deal. Plus, everybody who's used to the relative cheese of the series wanted to see something big and grand.
Oh, yeah. No, I, you know, again, I call it ship porn. But it gets all the geeks And I'm not exempting myself from that group, but it gets all the geeks excited because, half of them, that's all they want to see. They want, the schematics and the diagrams, and they want the computers, and they want all the equipment. It's all they care about. The story is irrelevant.
Oh, yeah, and it works. I mean, it delivers what you want it to deliver. My problem isn't with that part of it. We'll get to when I have problems with the movie, but...
But so I will say, when I went to watch this, I probably haven't watched it in some time. Probably about every 4 or 5 years I watch this. So it's been probably 4 or 5 years. And I put it in the DVD player. And of course, I have a new-ish DVD player. It's probably 4 years old too. And it sometimes surprises me because it's on the cusp of becoming obsolete because I can no longer update its firmware. Thank you, Samsung. So certain new DVDs really give it a struggle to play. Because, of course, all the new Blu-rays have even more crap loaded on them and bloatware and all this garbage. When I went to play it, it started playing the score. And I thought, oh, God, there's no picture. My DVD player is on the fritz again. So I spent, like 2 or 3 minutes just trying to figure out what the hell was going on. And then I'm like, oh, so I restarted the Blu-ray player, restarted my TV, restarted the amp, made sure everything, because I have 7.1 surround in the living room. So I've got a home theater, and so I thought maybe something's not quite hooked up right. The HDMI is not switched over or something. So I did all this, start up again, score starts, blank screen. I'm like, oh, crap. So I thought, well, I'm going to skip forward a chapter, right, on the DVD, because I thought maybe it just doesn't like that first chapter in the DVD player. Who knows, right? So I skip forward a chapter, and the movie starts in the beginning. So apparently there's an entire hidden track, but it's not really hidden as much as before the movie.
No.
Just the score.
No, it's better than that. It's on the streaming version too.
Awesome.
No, it's motherfucking 2001 is what it is. Starts with a black screen with classical music playing.
Well, I'm glad it wasn't just me because I haven't seen it before. And so on the last version that I have on the old, probably on the standard definition DVD, it doesn't have that. It goes right into the movie. And so I was freaking out, and then I felt like an idiot.
No, I felt the same way streaming it. I'm like, oh, we finally got the fast internet I wanted, but now, what, it's not playing? Is the girl trying to download something or stream something too? This stupid, do I have to, unplug my router and plug it back in? Yeah, I wish I had it. I wish I could go buy it in the store, but I can't find it. Yeah, it turns out it's 2001.
Yeah, it really is.
Because it's not even the theme of, it's not the iconic Star Trek theme written for this movie. It's actually another piece of music that then swells into what we now know as the Star Trek theme. Like, this score on this movie is impressive.
Oh, yeah. No, it was amazing. It was very symphonic, but...
Yeah, no, it's Jerry Goldsmith, and you can actually buy a 3-CD set of the theme and the score to this movie. Like, it's got the main score of the movie. It's got all of the little tags. It's got bonus things that weren't used in the movie, but were recorded for the movie. Yeah, it's incredible that a lot of thought went into the music to this.
No, we are not going to discuss what I own, but we will move forward.
Okay. So, well, you don't have Star Trek: The Motion Picture on ice, do you?
I do not. Are you telling me such a thing exists?
No, I'm not. I made that up.
Oh, I was so hopeful for a moment, and like you filled me with joy. I was like, the best worst thing ever.
Oh, come on. You could see Chekhov doing a triple Lutz.
Oh, I would pay $40 for that DVD. I would totally buy that.
I don't know. If for $40 I would want that and the Jeffersons on ice too.
Exactly. That too.
Anyway, okay, so shall we launch into the plot of this movie?
Yeah.
It's actually not gonna be a big deal because there are some things that slow this so far down that the plot is not a huge... Okay, so...
There isn't much plot. I mean...
Yes. The movie opens with 3 Klingon ships. Very iconic shape to the Klingon ships. And they're encountering this huge energy cloud. And they got the Klingon language. And because Klingons are a war-like race, species, they fire photon torpedoes into the cloud, and it returns fire and vaporizes them. So then we cut to planet Vulcan, where Spock is doing the final phase of the Kolinar.
And so I wrote down, is that Bill Murray? It's Spock's Kolinar? Because the one dude totally looked like Bill Murray. It's not, but...
Oh, it's funny, though. Well, I was just impressed. I was a little bit upset when she dropped that fused glass necklace onto the dirt.
It struck at your soul a little bit.
Well, it's like, man, I mean, that's probably 40, 50 bucks at like a craft show.
Yeah.
But yeah, so he's going through this final phase where all emotion is freed from the body and you give yourself to total logic. And now, am I to think that only human Vulcan half-breeds have to go through this process?
No, it's a ritual that all the Vulcans go through.
Okay. All right. So Vulcans aren't completely emotionless.
Right, they have to shed them.
Okay, but Spock stops the ceremony when he receives this weirdo message from outer space, and the person conducting the ceremony, the lady there, the Lady Vulcan, is disappointed to say the least, and dumps his necklace in the dirt.
Yeah, but he picks it up with longing.
Oh yeah, yeah. There's a lot of pathos going on with Spock. So we cut to Earth, and the Starship Enterprise is undergoing a major refit. And Admiral James T. Kirk works in San Francisco as the chief of Starfleet operations. He has been away from active captaining for 2 years, 2.5 years, something like that. But he's going to the ship not only to kind of take a look at the old bird, but in his inimitable Captain Kirk way, he has managed to trick his way into being the captain of the Enterprise again through all sorts of Kobayashi Maru sort of shenanigans. Because remember, Captain Kirk is notable. Well, we learn more in Star Trek 2, right? Where he's notable for cheating on the final test.
Well, he didn't cheat. He just rewrote the rules.
Yeah, well. So he goes to kind of kick the tires in the Enterprise. But the problem is they've had reports of this cloud entity is coming into Federation space and headed directly to Earth. So the Enterprise is the only ship in the area that can get there fast enough to figure out how to solve the problem. And that's when we have what I call a lingering 2001 sequence.
Including, yeah, this is the ship porn.
Yep, and all of the Trekkies get their technology fixed, and they see the Enterprise inside and out. And the version that I saw, there was one thing glaring, where when they were in the little shuttle, Scotty and Kirk... Especially when they turned and backed up to dock on the actual Enterprise because the transporters had...
Yeah, where the resolution fails.
Well, and yeah, it's just a projection on the little screen. Yeah. It was funny because they had to... On the ship itself, when they filmed that, all of the dialogue on the ship had to be recorded after the fact because when they were actually running through and filming it, all of the screens... were 16mm projectors onto little screens. So you had like 20 16mm projectors. Wow. So it was just a cacophony of noise.
There's just a bunch of clacking.
So anyway.
Those projectors are hot too. That would have been just a terrible place to be.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I'm sure the outside of this set was just terrible. And the inside was probably, you know, with all the lights and stuff.
I bet it smells bad, too, all those costumes.
Well, and the costumes, by the way, the costumes that were, in retrospect especially, awful.
Yeah, those outfits, I'm sorry, but those little white jumpsuits with the black belt things, what the hell was... God, it was the 70s. I mean, it was totally the 70s, but oh, it was terrible.
Well, no, it looked like everybody won the technology rodeo with those big belt buckle things. Turns out there was a whole... thing that each of those belts actually connected to the sick bay, but that was just a plot element that they didn't use.
Didn't realize.
Yeah. Plus, it took another person to help you get your uniform off. So it was a nightmare from wardrobe. In fact, when they went to do the second movie, they said, we'll only do it if we change the wardrobe.
Well, duh.
Yeah, well, and as we talk about later, or we'll talk about, I'm sure, next week, the wardrobe in Star Trek 2 is so much better.
Star Trek 2 is just, I mean, we cut to the chase. It's just a better movie.
Oh, yeah, it is. Yeah. And again,
exponentially better than this.
Well, yeah, this was trying to do two things, and it didn't do either of them particularly well.
No, it really tried to overreach on the redemption and the reestablishment, and it just kind of, it was going too many different directions at once.
Well, the thing about
it went nowhere.
Well, and we'll talk about next week again. Star Trek II is an action movie. And this was not an action movie, and it was not an action movie on purpose. They did not want to make Star Wars. That was the whole point. It's like, we have a different animal here. We've got this character piece. We have this group of people that everybody loves, and they go out and have this little morality tale as well as having action and adventure. So this can't be a shoot 'em up kind of movie. This has to be...
This is very much 2001.
Yeah.
And the parallels are stark because, again, this is spoilers here.
No, it's a fucking space baby at the end.
Yeah, that's what I wrote down, the birth of a baby. I mean, it's a space baby. I mean, it's 2001. I mean, it's not even couched in any kind of subtlety. Again, this is like a bunch of scissors.
Yeah, no. Decker would have said, oh my God, look at all the stars.
Full of stars.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we need like the scissors scale. We need to establish the scissors scale.
Yeah, this is definitely a four scissors movie.
Yeah, I'm gonna start working on that.
Okay, all right.
the official Brothers Anderson scissors scale subtlety.
Yes,
and that's an alliteration.
No, the scissors subtlety scale. Yeah. It's an alliteration. I can't say the scissors subtlety scale. Okay, so
I gotta write that.
You should. Are you kidding? I could put little scissors icons just kind of hidden away on the cover of each episode.
Easter eggs.
Yeah, it'd be hilarious.
There you go.
So Kirk arrives on deck, and we see the crew reunion, and only Scotty knows that he's taking command. I mean, he's the admiral. He's they're happy to see him. At least the characters are, if not the actual actors. And, but he's come to give everybody the news that they're going, instead of like basically doing a check flight where they check all the refits. They're going to have to actually go on a real mission. Oh, and by the way, he's going to be a captain. He's taking a temporary demotion, citing his experience. So after he makes, kind of waves at the crew on the bridge, he's got to go down to the engine room to talk to the captain, who doesn't realize he's about to be replaced and also demoted, by the way. That would be Captain Willard Decker, played by Stephen Collins, most notably for being the dad in Seventh Heaven and having a very unfortunate divorce deposition.
Yeah.
Let's just say we wouldn't want him to be our babysitter.
Yeah.
So anyway, Stephen Collins, and you mentioned it before, he apparently claimed he's never seen the actual television show. So he doesn't know anything about these characters. He doesn't have any rapport with the actors. And it's awesome because he is just as insubordinate as Kirk is from the get-go.
Yeah, I wrote down, I said it's funny that Kirk thinks that Decker is just a pipsqueak, except that Decker's doing exactly what Kirk has always done.
Oh, yeah. He does such a good job without them having to spell it out to you.
Yeah. Stephen Collins really, I mean, he was the most earnest of all of the actors in this. He really sold it. And, of all the characters, again, I think he was the best actor out of the slot, but his performance was the best. I mean, he really stole the show. And so.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, hats off to him, because you're right. He was completely earnest in it. And his character is an unhappy guy. He's just... he knew Kirk because Kirk recommended him for the captain job.
Emergency shutdown trips.
Admiral Kirk. Oh, we're getting a top brass send-off. Don't worry, she'll launch on schedule. We have to tow her out with our bare hands. Right, Scotty?
That we will, sir. Let's talk.
Sure. Let me know when that backup's ready.
Aye, sir.
All due respect, sir, I Hope this isn't some kind of Starfleet pep talk. I'm really too busy.
I'm taking over the center seat, Will.
You're what?
I'm replacing you as captain of the Enterprise. You'll stay on as executive officer. Temporary grade reduction to commander.
You personally are assuming command?
Yeah.
May I ask why?
My experience. 5 years out there dealing with unknowns like this. My familiarity with the Enterprise, its crew.
Admiral, this is an almost totally new Enterprise. You don't know her a tenth as well as I do.
That's why you're staying aboard. I'm sorry, Will.
No, Admiral. I don't think you're sorry. Not one damn bit. I remember when you recommended me for this command. You told me how envious you were and how much you hoped you'd find a way to get a starship command again. Well, sir, it looks like you found a way.
Not very subtle. That was like a 6 on the scissor scale.
Oh, no, no, he is insubordinate. I mean, he deserves a demotion because he is, you know, in a strict military fashion. At least later, when he tells it like it is, he asks permission to speak freely.
Yeah. Well, there's a fair bit of, there's a fair bit of that.
Yeah. Well, and then the Enterprise has some issues, which always makes for good fun. Because, you know, that's the thing, is there's some characters that you can rely on to be fun. Scotty is one of them. And the fact that some of the new systems aren't quite, have the kinks worked out. For instance, the port transporter.
Oh, I've forgotten about that part, too.
I mean, that's kind of a really dark moment.
Yeah, and I didn't, but also the actors' reactions to the death, like Scotty and Kirk's reactions, like how they look at each other, like
exactly. Well, I always thought it's so funny that Kirk jumped in to like move the little sliders in the transporter, like he was going to massage it to work right. It's like, come on. But again, he's Kirk.
And so in later Star Trek years, in the Next Generation, I believe it was Captain Picard who had the unfortunate, he had to scatter somebody's ions out into the unisphere or whatever. And so I think he pushed one of the transporter guys aside and said, you shouldn't have to do this. This should be a captain's job. If I have to kill somebody with the transporter, it should be the captain or something.
Yeah, well, that was on purpose. Kirk was trying to lend a hand. I mean, it's not suggested in any way that Kirk killed these guys.
No.
But yeah, no, it was like, I mean, it was.
But I think the logic is that if in an instance when you know you're going to end up having to be killed in a transporter abortion, as it were, that it's the captain's responsibility to do that, since it really shouldn't fault any of the crew to have to do that.
Well, and another thing that makes me like this movie more, that I wouldn't, I mean, I was into this movie when it came out in 79 because I was a kid in the 70s that watched Star Wars and Close Encounters and all those movies and loved that whole thing. I mean, I had the Star Trek, you know, figures and everything. But as an adult watching it now, I have the added advantage of seeing and loving Galaxy Quest.
Exactly.
So Galaxy Quest does what this does. I mean, there it was directly a send-up of this scene, except that they kept the transporter malfunctioned people on the deck with them, and that's where they had baloney thrown at them.
Yeah, they exploded inside out monster.
Yes. So, you know, that's that made it all the, I mean, it funny, but it, I mean, the line is chilling.
Oh, my God. Starfleet, do you have them?
Enterprise. What we got back didn't live long, fortunately.
It's like, yeah, oh, shit. That is like some hard stuff.
Well, and then the transporter, the chief, the girl that's there, the lady, you know, they're like, well, it wasn't your fault. Gotta go. Yeah. You know?
Exactly. Like, well, and
good,
you know,
good luck,
and
finish, good luck finishing your shift.
Yeah. And Kirk, you know, he goes out because he's got to go to this meeting where he's having all hands on deck, have tips, telling him what, you know, giving them the briefing on what the assignment is. And you
four,
think
four less hands, though.
Well, yeah. And you think you're going to have, you know, he pauses in the hallway and you think, oh, he's going to have a moment of like realizing that somebody just died. No, he pauses and then he asks a girl for directions and that's it.
Because he's lost.
Yes. Yeah. Then we go
right there.
Yeah. Well, then we go to the big crew meeting and we have everybody, all these diehard Trekkies all dressed up and they made some interesting costume choices. did you notice, apparently, Starfleet is one of the Starfleet, employees or, soldiers or whatever they're called, crewmen is Iron Eyes Cody.
I didn't equate that, but I did see it. So
yeah, it was like, okay, we got the tall guy with the big head who I just assume, of course, is Stephen Merchant. And then we have Iron Eyes Cody crying because of this space garbage that maybe he was upset because they littered the crewmen all over the Starfleet's. Anyway, and then, so, so
I'm dying.
Well, okay, let me give you my perspective on this meeting. Okay, we've called them all together. We have some pans of all the Star Trek fans, which are great. It's fantastic that they did this. Don't get me wrong. I love the fact that they included the fans in this whole thing. And so they're in this briefing and you've got the captain of your ship briefing you on what the thing is. And then Uhura takes a cell phone call. I mean, that's what it amounts to.
Yeah.
It's like, captain, you got a call. Okay, put it up on the screen. It's like it could have been his mom. I mean, yeah. So he puts on the screen.
It could have been sexting or something.
Yeah, it could have been exactly. Yeah, some green chick. Yeah. But luckily though, well, luckily for a moment at least, they're getting an urgent call from Epsilon 9, the Starfleet monitoring station. Which, by the way, that looked pretty good. If that was the job of that craft, is to monitor signals all over their sector of the galaxy or whatever, that was a nice looking model of a ship.
Yeah, but this is where one of the things falls apart for me though. So yes, you have the Epsilon station and you have there, and then eventually, unfortunately, they get destroyed as everybody's watching. If they get destroyed, how can the Enterprise still see what's out there?
Well, yeah, exactly. The signal starts to fade because they're being attacked. And then Kirk says, external view. Like, how does that work? How do you get an hold on. I don't think we have Epsilon 10 is the camera ship that follows around Epsilon 9. I don't get that quite.
So, yeah. You could drive trucks through some of the holes in the plot. So,
yeah. Well, by the way, Epsilon 9 holds a small warm spot in my heart because that's what I've done for a living for the last 20 years, pretty much. Well, actually longer than that, because I was pretty much, if it would have been Hotel Epsilon 9, it would have been the same job. I mean, they're the telephone operators out in space. They're like, yeah. we're coming across this crazy chatter here, and oh, shit.
Building's on fire, gotta go.
Exactly. Oh no, they're asking to reverse the charges. Don't reverse the charge. Anyway, yeah, so the energy cloud destroys the ship. And by the way, this is another piece of stolen from 2001. And we have a lot of scenes of those guys with the jetpacks outside of the spacecraft, which is fine. I mean, it's nice. But there's the one scene where as the ship, the Epsilon 9 is getting destroyed and through all these effects, it's kind of going along the ship and like vaporizing it. I just like to say
it's actually not getting destroyed though. That's the thing.
Oh well, it's getting assimilated, right? Or digitized.
It's getting cataloged, because what they do is they preserve it.
Yeah, it's getting cataloged like a motherfucker. It's getting cataloged out of existence.
Well, except that as you saw, when you go inside, you know, the inner butthole of Viger, wherever you are, you know, in Viger's rectum or whatever that whole thing, you know, that whole orifice thing.
I like to call it, I do believe it's called the space sphincter.
Okay, I'll go with that.
Okay.
But everything, you know, there's stuff inside. There's planets and there's all kinds of stuff.
So are you saying that like Jerry and Denise, who were the operators on duty when the ship was cataloged, are like, it's like sipping on their chai latte still?
Oh no, they dead.
Yeah, I was gonna say yes.
But I'm saying, but they're dead in, probably frozen in place.
Well, that's comforting, I suppose. It's like, yeah, I suppose. You're never going to find out how that movie ends, you know, when you get off shift.
Yeah, it's true.
So anyway, no, but there's the scene where the guy in the jetpack, the wave of whatever energy, he goes along and then he just kind of bounces up against whatever's in the foreground. And it was the same awkward movement that we had in 2001 when we have the guys go, when Hal kills the guy who's on his little mission.
Yeah.
Outside of the ship. His little spacewalk. And then we cut to the bridge and we meet our first Deltan. This is Navigator Lieutenant Ilya, who is played by Persis Kambata. Persis Kambata.
Yeah, and you know what? And so she was from India. And she died very early, by the way. She died in 98. She was only 49 years old when she died.
Oh yeah, it's not great.
But I like how her line is, like, she immediately tells Kirk, like, I have an oath of celibacy. And I'm like, oh, she's watched the show before.
Well, that is a funny line, but okay, apparently, and this is in the novelization, and I don't know whether it was in some version of the script, but they couldn't shoot it for what's going to be obvious when I tell you what it is. But apparently the Deltans are a highly sexual species.
Yeah.
Like, in fact, later she mentioned something about how she wouldn't sexually take advantage of a lower life form or something. But everybody is super attracted to her. In fact, there's a scene that wasn't shown where Sulu can't stand up because he's got a boner.
there's actually a couple deleted scenes where Decker has instructed Sulu to show Ilya how her workstation works, and he can't.
He's
unable to like form sentences. So because they apparently have such strong pheromones, they drive men crazy, and so.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's. But I love that their first line is, "My oath of celibacy is on record, Captain. May I assume my duties?"
Yeah.
So. And then, so we got that little, shut down by the ball chick. And then we've got this curmudgeonly guy who he refuses to be beamed aboard the ship. For reasons that if he's seen the last couple scenes, can make complete sense.
Totally rational to me. Like, I've never used one ever.
Yeah. And Kirk is like, oh no, we'll get that, you know, you will beam that crew member on now. And of course, who is it? But Commander Leonard Bones McCoy, MD.
Oh, it looks terrible too.
Okay, and I got a question for you. Okay,
looks like he's been on a bender for like a year.
Well, I love his like old man in the sea beard, but looking at his, especially this particularly piece of bad dialogue, really bad, fun.
Oh yeah,
but bad. I see Bones. As if he didn't have that strong Southern accent, he'd be a Jew. He would be like, I picture Larry David mixed with Rabbi Shmuley. Because he is like, he's very wise. He's given him, he's feeding lots of wisdom, but he's also super whingy. He's Carl Pilkington.
Yeah, he's totally curmudgeonly too.
Yeah.
He's a total buzzkill.
Well, for a man who swore he'd never return to Starfleet,
just a moment, Captain, sir. I'll explain what happened. Your revered Admiral Nagura invoked a little-known, seldom-used reserve activation clause. In simpler language, Captain, they drafted me.
They didn't.
This was your idea. This was your idea, wasn't it?
Bones is a thing out there.
Why is any object we don't understand always called a thing?
Headed this way. I need you. Damn it, Bones. I need you. Badly.
Yeah, I was fine. I just was trying to get through the day.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, I'm retired. I like drinking. Like, leave me alone. And then, of course, Kirk does this, damn it, Bones, I need you.
I need you.
Badly. It's like, well, hold on. I didn't think this. It was that kind of movie. I mean.
I know. They need to just hump it out right
that's,
there.
That's why he calls him Bones, I guess. But, no, but I love his little throwaway line at the end where he's like, well, Jim, I hear Chapel's an MD now. I'm going to need a top nurse, not a doctor who's going to argue with every little diagnosis with me. Then they probably redesigned the whole sick bay. I know engineers, they love to change things. To me, it totally is Rabbi Shmuley mixed with a little Larry David.
Yeah, but there's a lot of little things in here that are funny, hilarious, like just like on their own singular, you're like, wow, but you have to go back and remember it was 1979 because his outfit and the jewelry, and, you know, just like is in the open shirt, like down to his belly button.
Oh, yeah, with all the chest hair and everything.
Yeah. And then it was like, is that Larry from Three's Company?
Exactly.
Is he living inside DeForest Kelly's outfit?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Leisure Suit Larry on Star
Trek? It's Leisure Suit Larry mixed with Mr. Furley.
Exactly. So I also wrote down, wow, somebody paid a lot for those motorized headrests.
Oh my God. Yes. Yeah, they probably paid for the undercoating too.
Like, what gimmick? Because they used it repeatedly. I'm like, why was this a big gimmick selling point?
Oh, they paid for it. They probably had, I'm sure they had power windows too.
Oh my God. Of all the things that this movie didn't need, it was powered headrests.
Oh, it's a fun touch, though. I mean, I like that kind of thing, especially since some of it was. We'll talk a little bit later, but some of the bridge components were as cheesy.
You're traveling through space at better than light speed at this point, and this little flimsy metal headrest is going to save you. That's what's going to stop everything from destroying you.
Oh, see,
you're worried about.
I thought it was strictly for like. Federations for Disabilities Act, where, you know, you have neck repetitive motion.
Neck fatigue.
Yeah, exactly. So
I see.
Your little cowboy belt buckle thing will send a message to sick bay, who will send a message back to raise your headrest.
Well, maybe so.
Yeah. So, hey, you know what this movie didn't have? It was Kirk, jogging upside down in the sick bay? Like
almost.
In the original. So anyway, so next thing, Kirk takes them out of the little spaceport thing. And this is, again, something that Galaxy Quest did so well when they did their little spoof of it where they scrape along the side. That was in direct response to this particular scene, which was beautiful.
It was. Well, because you got Sulu and his little stick.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, doesn't show up ever again.
I do believe, Captain, that would be an adequately sized stick. Oh, I can't do a Sulu impression.
And the rest of the the con doesn't work like that. So, can we just say, I love George Takei.
Oh, me too. George Takei is fantastic.
He is. Yeah, I love him.
Well, no, even his, you know, talking about how the other actors, like Walter Koenig and I don't know about DeForest Kelly, but Walter Koenig and Dersh Takei were both like, you know, this may be the Star Trek, but it doesn't feel like Star Trek. We don't have that same, you know, cohesive group of people we had before. Maybe it's because they couldn't all gang up on Shatner, because Takei is unabashed in his dislike of Shatner's, let's say, lack of professionalism. But he's so kind of snide about it. when they talk about how, you know, they're rewriting to the last minute, and Takei's like, yeah, they're rewriting to the last minute, mostly in Shatner's favor. I think I need more screen time.
This movie did not need more Shatner time.
No, actually, you know, it's funny because I think it had the right amount of Shatner. It seems like the movie went on forever, but there was no time for the Sulu shirtless sword fight.
No.
Because there was, you know, other stuff going on. Although, this is 40 minutes into the movie, and the Enterprise is just pulling out of the garage.
Yeah.
And they realize they need to get to this cloud as soon as they can because to maximize their time, they have to solve this problem. And so they have to jump to warp speed ahead of schedule, which, of course, is dangerous. And Decker doesn't like it. And so they fire up the engines, and they're going warp speed, but then they enter a wormhole. And this, even in the theater, I was thinking, oh, this isn't great. These aren't great special effects. They're sort of everybody's, you know, sliding and time is slowing down and it's all out of shift.
Yeah, they're basically trapped in a pink sock.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it has this nice scene where Kirk has to, he orders phasers for an asteroid and Decker tells him to belay that order and shoot photon torpedoes. After which, Kirk drags Decker out by the ear into his quarters. And of course, Bones tags along because he knows that there needs to be a witness so that, because otherwise Kirk will be like, oh, he had a heart attack. He fell down and hit his head 19 times on my table.
He just accidentally tripped out the torpedo tube.
Oh, so, you know, another transporter accident. Scotty, get this shit working, okay? I need another executive officer, please. Anybody volunteer? Everybody steps back one step.
Yeah.
I didn't think so. But no, it was a fun scene because, you know, Stephen Collins pulls it off.
All right, explanation. Why was my phaser order countermanded?
Sir, the Enterprise redesign increases phaser power by channeling it through the main engines. When they went into antimatter imbalance, the phasers were automatically cut off.
And you acted properly, of course.
Thank you, sir. I'm sorry if I embarrassed you.
You saved the ship.
I'm aware of that, sir.
Stop competing with me, Decker.
Permission to speak freely, sir?
Granted.
Sir, you haven't logged a single star hour in 2.5 years. That plus your unfamiliarity with the ship's redesign, in my opinion, sir, seriously jeopardizes this mission.
I trust you will nursemaid me through these difficulties, Mr.
Yes, sir, I'll do that.
Then I won't keep you from your duties any longer, Commander.
He goes nose to nose with Kirk.
Again, he's totally earnest.
Yeah. And Kirk is like, stop competing with me, Decker. And, you know, Decker, like, there's no answer to it, but, I mean, the implication is like, sir, I'm not competing with you. I'm already better than you. Then we have the arrival of an old friend, the unexpected arrival of Commander Spock, who he's not been purged of all emotion, but he's damn close. And this is where we get the Bones and Spock quippery. That's always fun. Bones is, you know, is curmudgeonly, but Spock is just kind of a dick and a know-it-all. So it works out just fine. But Spock comes and saves the day, gets everything working just great, and they do warp speed to get to the energy cloud. By the way, the warp speed effect, even in the 79 version, is pretty great.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a little disco, but it's still fun.
Well, I mean, considering the time, it was the effect they had.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, much, you know, yeah. Like I said, it was fun to watch even now. So they reach the energy cloud and they get attacked and the shields hold, but they won't hold for much longer, of course, because that's the ongoing thing with the shields, poor Scotty. And then Chekhov gets burned. And that's where Spock discovers a way to talk to the alien. Because there's an alien in this cloud. And the cloud opens. And they're going toward the space sphincter. But like all good sphincters, what you need to appear around it is a probe. So a probe appears on the bridge. And this is an effect that I really liked. It wasn't too, like, technically difficult, but the sound that they used during the probe when it attacks people.
One big crazy Vandegaff generator.
Yeah, but the sound they use and kind of the jerky motion of the actors, like when Spock, like, falls across the whole bridge, it works really well. I was impressed.
My dog was barking at the TV so much when this was going on.
Oh, I'm sure.
Because I have full 7-1 surround in my living room now. And so I have speakers that are basically that encircle the whole room. And because... It had good surround sound in this movie. And so he's following the noise as it goes around the ship and it's flowing around my living room. At one point, he's like behind my couch, like growling.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was scary. I mean, you know, I'm sure in the theater this is awesome. So the probe appears, it attacks Spock, it kind of lightly attacks a bunch of other people, but it abducts Aaliyah. And then she is replaced fairly quickly by a robotic doppelganger. So she is now the human-type probe sent by V'ger, who is the entity in the cloud.
Except they kept... This is the one thing that kind of really got on my nerves. They made a big point. All of them made a point about saying, she's just a mechanism. Mechanism, like, give us a better word.
Yeah. Well, she had the light-up stoma.
Yeah.
And, of course, Decker is distraught because it's alluded to, like, she and Decker have given each other familiar longing gazes before. So they had a romantic history back when he lived on Delta. And I will refrain from breaking into the song Delta Dawn as much as I want to. I'm almost powerless.
Yeah.
All I can think of was, could it be a faded rose from Marmac 6? Anyway, so I know. I'm telling you, not great. It's not great living in my brain, but what can you do? So, Decker, she's trying to get a bunch of information from the ship, and Decker's trying to get her to remember her memories and the feelings buried within her. And that's when Spock takes a spacewalk. He attempts to do a Vulcan mind meld with V'ger itself. And this is total 2001. Because he's in a damn suit with the helmet on, where you see the reflection across the face mask, and it's done well, but it's total 2001.
Well, yeah, that and the fact that, you know, it's clear that he's overloaded with everything that he gets to see when he touches V'ger.
Yes. Yeah, he should know by now that mind melding is a dangerous business.
Well, especially an unknown quantity that they keep telling, you know, has power that they've never seen before and a size they've never seen before. What did you think was going to happen?
Well, also, I mean, theoretically, could Spock someday try to do a Vulcan mind meld with like a Samsung Galaxy Note 3? I mean, or a toaster. Yeah. I mean, exactly. It's like this microwave oven. I sense its feelings calling to me. I don't know how that works, but.
Yeah.
So That's when he learned that V'ger is a living machine. And also like 2001, Kirk has to go out and rescue his friend out in the OA suits or whatever. I guess that's one of the scenes in the director's cut that's like you get to see Kirk suit up.
Yeah. But, it's actually, it's one of the deleted scenes.
Yeah, in the version that I saw, he just kind of appears out there and grabs Spock's limp body. Much, by the way, did you see that thing on the news about that skydiver that had a seizure in the air?
No.
Yeah, he was falling. He had a seizure, and it wasn't tandem. It was by himself. But luckily, his one of the instructors on the jump, also who was happened to be wearing a GoPro, had to go and pull his ripcord, and he finally regained consciousness like just a little bit before he landed.
So yeah, if I was prone to seizures, I don't know if he'd be jumping out of a plane.
You, well, exactly,
without being tandemed.
Well, it seems like maybe he falsified a form, or maybe what an inopportune time to have your first seizure.
Yeah.
Scary
stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What causes seizures? Oh, I don't know. Jumping from 10,000 feet or whatever. I don't know how high you are when you jump, but seems pretty awesome that you got saved though.
Yeah, that's pretty spooky.
Yeah. So, they end up at the heart of the massive ship. And by the way, this is also 2001 kind of, you know, it really is great special effects they're doing as far as like, the ship itself that V'ger made, because it's just massive. And it's revealed to be Voyager 6, a 20th century space probe.
You have to give them credit that it wasn't just a big black monolith, that it had, you know, they had to literally go outside the box.
Very nice. You're right. It's in a... Although I was reminded online that, you know, there was actually an episode of the TV show where they have a space probe like wandering around the Enterprise.
Nomad.
Yeah. So the idea of the rogue space probe is not exactly new, but, you know, at this point, you're almost 2 hours invested in the movie. So what are you going to do? And then I guess the probe was found by an alien race of living machines. So it needed to go find its creator, and the machines upgraded the probe to fulfill its mission, and it gathered so much knowledge that it achieved consciousness. So Spock realizes that V'ger lacks the ability to give itself focus other than its original mission. Having learned what it could on its way home, it finds its existence empty and without purpose. It is like a child. It knows it needs something, but it doesn't know what it needs.
I'm giving that 7 scissors on the 10 scale.
Yeah. So V'ger insists that the creator come in person to finish the sequence. By the way, the original pilot for Star Trek Phase 2 was where the Enterprise meets God. That's what this script was. And they thought, oh, we can't get away with God.
No kidding.
They were also toying with going back in time and preventing the Kennedy assassination.
Ooh.
Yeah, which would have been kind of rough.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that wouldn't have been good.
Yeah, and we found out with other time travel movies, time travel is sometimes an issue. We'll find out also in Star Trek IV. So basically, Decker, by the way, hero of this story, could have been a long-time Kirk adversary through... What, 6 other movies and maybe beyond? Could have had a series of action figures with different costumes on. Nope. Sorry.
He pulled his Xanadu.
Yeah. Yeah, you and the bald girl get to go away forever.
No, totally, it's Xanadu.
Yeah. Absolutely.
They were like roller skating in the sky.
Except that you don't hear cheesy, what is it, Greek gods.
Careful.
Oh, you like Xanadu?
I do like Xanadu. Let me rephrase that. I like the music from Xanadu. The movie, not so much. And I don't think Travis had ever seen Xanadu. However, I made him watch it, I think a year or two ago, a year before he left. And I don't think he's ever forgiven me.
Oh, we should do Xanadu with Travis.
Oh, it's so bad.
Oh, I know. I listened to the podcast, How Did This Get Made? About Xanadu. It's very funny. You should seek it out.
Oh, it's so bad. Oh, and I hadn't seen it in a long time. And of course, I remember every song word for word to this day. But, oh, what a terrible movie. Just a terrible, terrible movie. Just, I was embarrassed.
But well, you know, a roller skate movie is one source of embarrassment. ELO, though, is a solid band, and Jeff Lynne from ELO, he created a lot of that like pop rock of the late 80s, early 90s. Like that whole Traveling Wilburys and George Harrison's Cloud Nine and two Tom Petty albums. I mean, they were all Jeff Lynne produced. Anyway, sorry. Are you still there?
Yeah.
Comcast, are you still there?
I'm still here.
Anchorage calling Comcast.
So at one point where they're talking about, they're having this whole moment with V'ger, and they're talking about how, you know, it's just trying to find itself. And I wrote down, V'ger, very good existential, that word, representation.
Ah, that's very nice.
Because it is this whole existential kind of crisis machine.
Oh, yeah, completely. And Decker's great. Decker's like, hey, first of all,
fuck it, I'm out.
Well, yeah, he's like, hey, my bald girlfriend is gone. And I hate these assholes that came up and took my gig away, man.
They took my ship away.
Yeah. Bunch of the ones that aren't incompetent are just jerks. So, yeah, hey, can I put on a red shirt for you guys? I'm going to be happy to. I'll just merge with V'ger. Or maybe he's, what is that word? I can't think of it now. What's that? When you have a fetish where you're sexually attracted to things like buildings or cars?
I have no idea what that's called.
Like you know, like it's not bad to like, you know, hey, lots of people love cars. Just maybe you shouldn't love your car.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, so maybe he's just been looking to get a little digital probe himself. And we're going to change that whole subject now.
Wow. Oh, okay.
Anyway. So, at the end, everybody gets what they want. The captain gets his Enterprise back. Decker gets the girl, sort of. Spock is back on board.
So he basically gets a real doll, doesn't he, at that point?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, kind of. Well, but they both get to live in digital bliss.
Or something.
Or something, yeah. Maybe his heirs can get his insurance policy with the Federation. I don't know how that works out, but... you know what? He won't, because they're not declared dead. They're declared missing.
Yeah.
His heirs will never get a check. Oh my God, what a horrible thing. His mom outside of his house in Springfield, whatever unmentioned state, Decker's mom is going to have like a POW MIA flag hanging out of her house forever. Always wondering if her little boy Will is going to come home. All because Captain Kirk thought it more poetic to say he was missing instead of killed. Anyway. Maybe there's a rule about so many years you get your death benefits. I don't know how the Federation works. Don't press me for details, people. So
yeah, who knows?
At the end, Kirk directs the Enterprise out into space for future missions. Which way do we go? Go that away.
Well, yeah, that was
But it ends with the bombastic theme song music, which is great. And overall, like I said, you know, Kirk and Spock have fairly juicy roles. Scotty and Bones are great because they're important characters and comic relief in a lot of cases. Sulu, Chekhov, and Uhura are just barely there, so I can understand how they would felt like the beginning short shrift. But Decker has a huge role, and Collins just acts the shit out of it. I do believe that's what they say at the Academy Award nominations is. Best actor to act the shit out of a role in a science fiction or horror movie goes to. So, I thought, any other thoughts about Star Trek, the motion picture?
No, I mean, we've pretty much covered everything. We've beaten this horse to death.
Well, it's going to be, I was happy when you suggested that we just pile through. Because the next movie, and I know there's some cheese involved in the next movie.
Oh, yeah, but Ricardo Montalban, come on.
Oh, and the little earworm. I'm looking forward to that already.
That terrified me for decades.
Oh, and it's fantastic. It's exactly what you want. It's that Star Wars type, action movie.
Yeah.
Where you have spaceships fighting each other. That's all we wanted.
To the death.
Yeah, yeah. And they talk about the eugenics wars.
Yeah, and Moby Dick references.
Oh, it's crazy. So, yeah. So, first of probably 6 weeks of movie watching Star Trek shows.
Maybe 6 weeks. We'll see.
Yeah.
I don't know. Getting around Star Trek V will be very difficult. So,
well, they say the odd ones are the ones that have problems. So we'll see. We'll at least get through 5. How about that?
Yeah.
Because we have to get to 5. We can't stop at 4.
No, and 6 is a great movie. Star Trek VI is great.
I don't even remember it. I mean, I'm sure I saw it.
Undiscovered Country. I think we saw it together at the Fireweed, with the Fireweed 12.
Oh yeah, no, we must have. I mean, I'm sure I saw all these movies in the theater. There's no way I couldn't have.
I remember going to see Star Trek VI at the Fireweed. So
yeah, well, at least the first 4 of these movies were event viewing. You went to all the Star Wars movies, you went to all the Star Trek movies. That was just something you did to be a good American. Damn it.
Or something.
So, anyway. So, until next week, live long and prosper, Brother Jay.
And less scissors.
Less scissors. Yeah, go up with your scissor scale. Be hilarious. I can't wait.
I gotta work on that. I don't know how I'm going to do it, but yeah, I'm going to start working on that.
I can already see an icon if we do like 3.5 scissors where you have the half scissor.
Just one blade.
Yeah. Too funny.
All right.
Okay. I'll talk to you. Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on a new voicemail account to leave voice messages. Or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts, dial it already.